This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to a panel of experts about artificial intelligence, how it shapes our lives now, and the future of AI. We recorded this conversation in front of a live audience at the Orlando Science Center.
HP Newquist, the AI exhibit director, is one of the foremost authorities on the history and application of artificial intelligence. His career in AI spans four decades, beginning with the creation of AI Trends, the first ever publication to explore the practical use of artificial intelligence. HP, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Walt Wilson. He's Vice President of Operations for Winter Park-based Fleet Zoo. It's a cloud-based route optimization solution that includes order management, route planning and optimization, and real-time customer notification. Walt, thank you as well.
Matthew, thank you.
And we're also joined by Dan Myers, Assistant Professor and Chair of Computer Science in the Department of Math and Computer Science at Rollins College in Winter Park. He received his PhD in Computer Science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with research interests in computer performance modeling and queuing theory. Dan, thank you as well.
Great to be with you.
And Jeremy Joseph, Senior Manager of the Sensor Application Software Department with Luminar Technologies, an Orlando company producing advanced sensor technologies for the autonomous vehicle industry. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So, HP, I want to begin with you. If you had to sum up AI in a sentence, what would you say?
Well, artificial intelligence is the attempt by humans to create machines that behave like humans. There's your sentence.
And you've been working in this. You've been kind of writing about it, thinking about it for a long time, right? It's changed a lot since you first got involved. How does the reality of AI now compare to what you envisaged back in the 80s?
Well, right now, we have AI on almost every device that we carry with us. You've got Siri, you've got Alexa, you've got Google Maps, you've got Amazon recommendations, you've got Spotify, you've got Pandora. You can talk to your phone and it will respond to you. When I started in AI back in the 80s, if we could have done that then, it would have been over. We would have figured, we've done it, we've accomplished AI, we're finished. Here we are 30 years later, and we now take that for granted as sort of baseline. Like, yeah, our machines can do that. We don't even think of them as being that smart, even though that is AI. So the difference is that we've raised the bar. We now expect more from AI. We want it to start looking a little bit more human-like. We wanted to be able to interact with us even more familiar, with more familiarity. And it's a world of difference away from the years when we were just trying to get them to, you know, answer simple questions.
And you were writing about AI for a long time, then you stopped for a bit. What got you back into it?
AI basically, there was a huge, the first wave of AI started in the mid-80s to the mid-90s, and it was created primarily by the U.S. military. They funded a lot of companies that came out of MIT and Carnegie Mellon and Stanford. And roughly 500 companies came and went in the course of 10 years. They just could not develop the technology to deliver what they wanted. So it burned out. I burned out. And for the next 20 years after, say, 1995, there was really not much going on. And there were two things that got me back into it. One, which some of you may have seen, and if you haven't, we have the video in the exhibit, was a video by Boston Dynamics of a robot dog marching up a hill. And somebody kicks the dog. And the dog trips, but it catches itself, and it comes back. And I saw that video around 2013 and said, we tried for decades to do that. And that now it's happening. That was one thing. The other thing was cats. So we have dogs and cats. Google took an AI called a neural network and trained it to recognize cats by feeding it basically the information of millions of its YouTube cat videos. Millions and millions. So day and night for days, and eventually at the end of the trial period, the AI could recognize a new cat that it had never seen before because it had been trained on all these others. So between dogs and cats around the mid, 20-teens, it became apparent that AI was back. And certainly companies are investing billions of dollars now, and so are governments.
One of the things I noticed, when you look at those videos of the Boston Dynamics robots, and there have been several of them that they put out, every new little advancement, they show another video of what this robot can do.
Right.
The comments are divided between people who are either astounded and kind of welcome it or slightly terrified. So it seems like there's a bit of a dichotomy there, right?
Not slightly terrified. It's dramatically terrified. People look at it and they see Skynet, Cyberdyne, and the Terminator all in those robots. And there is something about seeing a creature that's completely mechanical, behaving like a dog that you have as a pet. And so that's frightening until you start considering it's not what it looks like, it's not what the technology is, it's what it's being used for. Mm-hmm. So those dogs are incredibly good at going into disaster areas where you've had earthquakes and fallen buildings and carrying supplies and aid into very dangerous places where people can't go. Unfortunately, because of the Terminator, because of Matrix, because of 2001: A Space Odyssey, we tend to think that what's really going to happen is that the dogs are going to turn on us and become our masters, and we will be the pets. We have to come to grips with how do we use the technology in a beneficial way.
Speaking of cat videos, Dan Myers, I want to bring you into this conversation.
Yeah. This is a subject that's relevant to my interests.
Sure. So it's interesting that something which is seemingly so trivial has, you know, given rise to such a massive advance in one of the aspects of AI, and it has all these applications now. Just give us a little bit of the background of the science behind it, how, you know, those videos that that HP was talking about sort of ended up getting fed into the matrix, mm-hmm, so to speak, mm-hmm, and we now have like these advancements in AI from that.
Yeah, so the cat video example is interesting because I was talking to a colleague from Elon University recently, and he actually did research on computer vision starting back in the 1990s when he was a grad student. And he said at the time that was exactly a problem that they were trying to solve. So can you recognize a subject of interest, like say a cat, in an arbitrary image? And he said basically the state of computer vision research in the 1990s was such that if you could recognize a cat maybe 30% of the time, you were a god. Now, basic image recognition problems like that are very close to being solved. So we can get accuracy rates into the upper 90% on being able to find things like cats, like dogs, like human faces, facial recognition, for example, in pretty much arbitrary images. So this is a case where the technology, again, if we look back in the 1980s or the early 1990s, people would have said if we could do image recognition at the level of quality that we take for granted nowadays, we would think that we had solved the problem of computer vision. So what changed really, so between the 1990s and now, is that there were really some actual engineering advances, development of new methods that sort of existed in more limited forms earlier in the history of artificial intelligence, but starting in the mid-2000s and particularly about 2010, got picked up and became much more sophisticated. So our computer hardware got a lot better, so we could train models that were more sophisticated, like the neural network models that you mentioned earlier, typically under the name deep learning is the term that you'll hear a lot nowadays. We also got much, much bigger data sets. So if you look back at the very early history of AI, the 1960s, 1970s, into the 1980s, data was very limited. So people had to think about how to be very, very clever with the limited amount of data that they had. And they tried to build very sophisticated reasoning systems. It turns out that's very difficult to do. The modern approach is more to start with a lot of data and then come up with ways of extracting meaning from that data. The internet has been great for us because it gives us huge repositories of things like cat images, and then we can develop engineering techniques or theoretical models for learning that can actually find the stuff that we're interested in inside all of that data.
The flip side of that, I'm wondering too, you know, when you sign into a website or something and you get this little pop-up which says, identify every image in this which is a bridge, mm-hmm, or a road or a street sign or something. So at a certain point, that is not going to work, right? Because computers will be able to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly. So for many of these types of learning methods, the starting point is a classified set of training data. So we have to have kind of some basis, some starting point, where we have a set of images that contain, say, cats, and some human has actually gone in and said, yep, that's a cat. No, that's not a cat. That's a dog. Yep, that one's a cat. That's not a cat, and so forth. So one thing that we could actually do is present humans maybe as part of a sign-in or authentication step, give them an image that hasn't yet been classified, and ask them to find, say, images of stop signs. Does this contain a stop sign or not? We'll let the human do the work of actually building the training data set for us. And then we can take that training data set, feed it with a lot of other images into one of these models, and then build the actual deep learning or AI model that we can then use as part of a production system.
So that's one aspect of AI and its application. Walt Wilson, tell me about Fleet Zoo, because you are using a different aspect of AI. What does your company do?
What we do is focus on something called the last mile problem, and that's a phrase maybe not many people have heard, but I'm going to guess that anybody listening to this has had a package show up at their house. For every dollar that it takes to get that package from the people who made the stuff until it lands at your front door, 53 cents of that dollar of cost come from the last mile, the last piece of getting it to show up in front of your house. There's a reason for that. You know, if you're sitting there and you're running a company trying to solve this problem and you've got 5 delivery people and 50 orders, you might think, okay, well, maybe there's a few hundred ways that they can get all these packages to where they need to go. Actually, when you do the math, it's not a few hundred or a few thousands, it's billions and billions of ways of doing it. I think it's a number with 64 zeros. That is a hard problem. So what we do is take what's called narrow AI, very focused artificial intelligence, and attack that problem so that we provide people trying to solve that problem a very simple way to press a button and say, aha, okay, for each of these drivers, here's the exact sequence of stops they should take. Here's what they need to do. And if they do this, they're going to drive less and spend more time delivering stuff. Or maybe if they're service providers, they'll spend more time working with customers doing the things that customers care about.
How do you get around things that you might not necessarily be able to foresee, like, say, a water main breaks on a road or something? Like, is there a way to use the technology to help drivers make real-time decisions so that they still get that package to where it's supposed to go on time?
Sure. What our tool does is it does that initial planning, and then there's another piece that the driver has. You know, if it's a great plan, it's not of a lot of use unless the driver knows where to go. So we deliver that onto their mobile phone. Part of what they see is not only where they need to go, but they can push a button and they'll get from another pool of artificial intelligence, here is, at this point in time, the best way to get from where you are to where you need to go. So it's both planning and then the real-time information so that they can execute as efficiently as possible.
And thinking about where the raw data comes from for, you know, object recognition, whether it's millions and millions of cat videos or pictures of cute dogs or what have you, where does your raw data come from?
Our raw data comes from really two sources. One is the list of customers that need to be served, and the other is we access several pools of data that deal with all of the roadways that are available to get that done, and the restrictions, the speed limits. Can I have big trucks, little trucks? We take all of that into account so that the plan that's delivered is realistic. You know, you have to take other things into account as well. Does it have to happen in the morning? Does it have to happen in the afternoon? Can it only happen by one driver or a driver with a certain type of skill? The artificial intelligence engine that we build takes all of these things into account so that what's delivered is not only optimal with air quotes, but is in fact optimal in a way that really solves business problems.
Mm-hmm. So companies like Amazon, for example, which are promising in some cases, you know, same day delivery, would they be able to do that sort of stuff without AI?
No, they would not. And companies like, okay, full disclosure time. Amazon doesn't need us. UPS, as an example, doesn't need us. Well, why is that? Well, UPS has a system. It's called Orion, which stands for something really esoteric. The point here is Orion cost them north of $1 billion to build. That's a billion with a B. And they're doing another generation. not many companies have $1 billion to throw at this problem. So what we do is make that level of technology available to companies that just want to solve the problem, not spend a ton of money trying to get it fixed.
Mm-hmm. HP, I see you kind of shaking your head there at the Amazon question. Are we sort of in a, you know how, for example, cell phones, you know, the chip gets smaller and smaller and they get more and more powerful. Are we kind of on the same tangent with AI, like things are just getting more and more advanced? Or are we going to sort of hit a level at some point where there's no further to go?
No, I think, and the reason I was nodding at Walt's comments is that when you have companies like Amazon and Facebook and Google, and they have access to data sets, which was just talked about a moment ago, in 1994, the largest data set in America was owned by American Express. It was a 5-terabyte data system, 5 terabytes. You can buy 5 terabytes on Amazon now in a small external hard drive for less than $200. It was the biggest one in 1994. That had all their customers, had all the companies that they serviced, that took the cards, addresses, and purchasing history. That's all they had. So anything American Express could have was basically name, rank, serial number, and purchases. Not a lot to deal or not a lot to draw from. But Amazon not only has your name, your address, your purchasing history, it has your preferences, your likes, your wish list, things that other people have recommended to you, other places that you ship to, gifts that you've given to other people. All of a sudden you have millions upon millions upon millions of pieces of data that don't fill 5 terabytes, which is this big today. They fill warehouses bigger than Home Depot all over the world with just that information. So it's not a question of, and does it get smaller and is it easier to pick the problem apart? It's how much more data can you use to perfect the solution? In Amazon, Google, Facebook, IBM, Microsoft, there are 5 companies that really have taken full advantage of the amount of data that they bring in to try and customize their marketing to you and their ability to identify the things that you want.
After the break, how artificial intelligence is helping drive the technology behind driverless cars. We're back in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We continue the conversation about artificial intelligence recorded in front of a live audience at the Orlando Science Center with HP Newquist, director of the Science Center's exhibit AI, Your Mind and the Machine, Dan Myers, chair of computer science at Rollins College, Walt Wilson with Fleet Zoo, and Jeremy Joseph with Luminar Technologies.
Jeremy Joseph, I want to move to you now. Also working in the field of transportation, but Luminar working on technology that allows autonomous self-driving cars to do what they do. So give us the kind of précis of what it is that you do and how that's helping move that forward.
Sure. So there's kind of 2 main aspects at Luminar. So we develop a hardware LiDAR sensor that is the eyes of a self-driving car. And then we also have an entire software department working on the AI problem for perception, object detection, lane tracking, that sort of thing. And kind of I'll echo that, you know, data is the most important thing here. So, you know, we have teams that just drive around and collect data with our sensors, and that's how we train our models, and that's how we get the actual results that we need. And you can never have enough data, really.
Right. So you're working on another aspect of the cat video, but it's cars kind of driving
yeah,
around.
Cars, people, signs, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have kind of a unique ability to get that data from a long distance, so 200 plus meters away. So we're able to train things at a lot farther distances, see pedestrians a lot farther away, and we wouldn't be able to even do that unless we collected enough data.
Is that also about the hardware? Like how fine-tuned do the sensors have to be able to pick that stuff up from that distance?
Yeah, so that's kind of the heart of Luminar is our IP around our sensors and our ability to see that far with as high a resolution as we can and the accuracy we can. There's nothing else on the market today that is in any kind of production capacity that can provide that kind of performance, and that's what you need to solve the last 1% of self-driving, which is things that you don't expect, especially, you know, things that have low reflectivity on a road, like a tire at 200 meters away or things like that.
Right, just drive on I-4 and there's a lot of unexpected stuff.
Exactly.
Right? But part of the time it seems it's more the human element, right? So I'm kind of wondering, because a lot of the questions around self-driving cars seems to be like you know, how safe is it going to be like? Is it? Mm-hmm. But if you take the human element out, is that going to make things safer in the end?
Yeah, so I mean, there's obviously a lot more work to do before you get to a point where there's no human in the car and the car makes all the decisions themselves. You know, the first part is just being able to get the car to, you know, see what it needs to see when it needs to see it in order to give enough time for a reaction to happen, whether that's a human reaction or a computer reaction.
And there is a lot of the, well, there's at least some autonomous technology kind of wired into cars today. Just give us a sense of what is already in place and some of the automobiles rolling off the out of the factory line today.
Sure, yeah. So the most common are the ADAS systems or the advanced driver assistance systems. These are like things that do like traffic jam, autopilot, parking automation, summoning your cars to you, things like that. So those are designed with a lot more focus and specialty in those particular areas. So they've got radar and ultrasonic sensors and things like that. And that problem's, easier to solve because it's bounded by a certain problem. So like if you're stuck on a highway and there's a car going, you know, in a traffic jam and it's only going 10 miles an hour or something, that's easier to keep your distance. You can see the car, things like that. That's kind of what rolls off the market today. Obviously, you've got some companies like Tesla who have a sort of full, you know, autonomous solution right now. But it's still not anywhere near. It could be where you don't have a driver at all forever, right? Like it's still got a long ways to go till that happens.
Right. And then you've got to think about, you know, if you are the human driver in that situation, you're in the left lane, somebody in front of you is driving too slow. There's people behind you got to be aware of as well. People right. like merging to the side of you. So it's a pretty complex scenario you're dealing with.
Yeah, and with that, you know, there's a lot of technology that goes into those cars. I mean, some of them have hundreds of sensors all around the car for all angles, so that they can work on that situation. I think the hardest problem right now is the high speed open. Area like on a highway where you're going 70 miles an hour and you only have, you know, 7 seconds to respond at, you know, a certain distance and, you know, you have to be able to see it that distance.
But does computer-assisted technology have an advantage there? Because, you know, there's a limit to how fast a human can respond to something at that speed.
Yeah, so part of the goal there is obviously when you have all the data in your training, you now can, you know, take like something like a LiDAR image, which is just a bunch of points in a cloud, and you can maybe get 3 or 4 points in the end on a pedestrian at 200 meters away and know that that's a pedestrian because you've run billions of data sets through it. And then you have plenty of time to react, and then a computer will always still react faster in that scenario than a human will.
Mm-hmm. Is Orlando a good place to be working on this kind of technology?
Yeah, so basically the reason we're in Orlando is UCF has what's called CREOL, which is the Center for Research and Education on Optics and Lasers. So our CTO, Jason Eichenholz, he got his PhD there. He started there. He had a company here. Luminar was actually founded in Palo Alto. We still have an office there, which is where a lot of the AI work is done. But basically, the hardware expertise comes from here in Orlando, and the data expertise and being able to generate what you need to actually accomplish self-driving mm-hmm. is here in Orlando.
And does any of what you're working on in the realm of self-driving cars and the kind of technology you need from that, does any of that stem from what the military has done, kind of to HP's point earlier on?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, of course, the military has been using LiDAR for many, many years, 30-plus years. A lot of aviation has used LiDAR. It's been used for a lot of different things. And a lot of the people that have kind of came from the IP and invented the technology that has become the proprietary sauce at Luminar come from that military background. So we've taken what we've learned from doing that aspect, both in software and in hardware, simulation included, and taken that lessons learned and learned how to build something that no one else has built before.
Mm-hmm. HP, I wonder if you could illuminate that a little bit more. Talk about how some of what, or a lot of what sort of, you know, was the original kind of genesis of AI came from that sort of military impetus and how that's changed now.
Well, the very first discussions of AI, well, the whole idea of man creating human-like objects goes back thousands of years. The ancient Greeks had mythology of giant metal men guarding the island of Crete. Come forward 200 years ago, you had Frankenstein, which was Mary Shelley, an 18-year-old girl creating really the prototypical bad machine going against its creator icon. So we've always had that imagery in fiction. But In 1956, a group of computer scientists at MIT, Stanford, and Dartmouth got together to see what they could do with these huge room-sized computers, because back then you had computers that would literally fill this room that weren't able to do anything more than 2 plus 2 equals 4, you know, 5 plus 5 equals 10. They could do basic calculations, but they took up entire rooms. They were looking forward towards what could be the future. And at this conference in 1956, they came up with an idea of, can we ever make these things think? And they pitched over the course of the late 50s, early 60s to DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the military. We can create things that will help you guide your missiles better. We will help you identify targets better. We will create programming methods that basically make you a much more efficient military. So through the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, even in the early 80s, DARPA paid for the vast majority of research, hoping to create essentially the smart army, the smart soldier. And when it didn't pan out, DARPA backed off a little bit, but corporate America got interested and picked up some of the slack. And then when it all fell apart, as I kind of mentioned earlier, in the 90s, until you had the Googles and the Amazons of the world, which had this huge amount of data and huge amount of cash to go with it, they saw the potential of doing it at a corporate level. So there's still a military aspect of it. I should say, and I say this to a lot of people, in 2017, Vladimir Putin gave a speech to every school child in Russia via satellite, where he said, the future of our society is AI, and the society that controls AI controls the world. For Vladimir to say that to every kid gives you a sense of how the military bent behind it could actually be deployed poorly. So there's certainly still a military interest in it. How do we create smart soldiers? How do we defend ourselves? But corporate America has really taken the lead on, or all corporations around the world have taken the lead, on pushing the technology further.
Well, just picking up on that idea of, you know, some of the unknowns down the track, I mean, what your company is working on is solving a pretty specific problem, but if you kind of pull out and take a 30,000-foot view, what are some of the things that you think about when you're like, well, you know, what sort of future are we heading into with artificial intelligence like 10, 20 years down the track?
What we look at is really how what we characterize as work in our society is going to begin to maybe split, if you will. there are a set of things that are very repetitive and, again, fit into what AI can address right now. And as the models and the compute power grow, that what is considered narrow now will be pretty wide. There will be in the future, though, there's some things that make humans special. We create, we innovate, we handle things that are kind of unpleasant and not well structured. So I think if you look at the future, AI will give rise to new opportunities for people to apply the human creativity in ways that don't exist right now. And there'll be jobs that we do right now that AI just can't do that require empathy and creativity and humanness, if you will. So to do nursing or to go to somebody's home and figure out how to make the air conditioner come back on. There's a lot of moving parts there that humans are really good at. They can sense the environment and bring a lot of things together to get to a solution. That is very, very hard to do, and I think that's where humans will continue to be the ones doing the doing. AI, though, is going to help. It's going to give us new tools.
Does it seem to you that, you know, just thinking of things we take for granted, like it would be hard for me to imagine now getting in my car, driving somewhere new and not putting Google Maps on my phone, right? I'm struggling to think the last time I actually pulled out a paper map and tried to do some route planning, you know, with a paper map. I'm wondering if we're kind of losing some of the things that we might have been good at doing before because we rely so much on these technological assistances.
I think there's some models that we can look at. This is not artificial intelligence, but this is an example, automation. Some of us can remember 30, 40 years ago when you wanted to get gas, you went to a gas station and an attendant came out and put it into the tank. You remember that?
They still do in some states,
they
right?
They do. Actually,
New Jersey requires it.
If you are not in New Jersey or Oregon, I believe, it really doesn't happen. And this is as of about maybe 10, 15 years ago. So today you go and you go inside, give somebody money, or you put a credit card into a pump machine and you pump your own gas, and that's great. So the job of attendant is gone. It has been eliminated. Well, what happened? The gas station has become a convenience store. There are people inside who are doing all of the food things that didn't exist before. And the helpful attendant that checked your oil is not doing that anymore. So a whole industry has sprung up of companies who do nothing but change oil and filters and things like that. So one industry goes away, other industries spring up. And I think AI, when you really look at it, because of what it does to enhance human creativity, will be a catalyst for new kinds of jobs that we really haven't thought of yet.
Still to come, how artificial intelligence is changing the way we learn and the way we work. Intersections back in a minute. Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're picking up the conversation about artificial intelligence recorded with a live audience at the Orlando Science Center. Joining me on stage were H.P. Newquist, director of the Science Center's exhibit AI, Your Mind and the Machine, Dan Myers, chair of computer science at Rollins College, Walt Wilson with Fleet Zoo, and Jeremy Joseph with Luminar Technologies.
Picking up on some of those thoughts, Dan, one of the other things that you're interested in following is how AI applies to teaching and learning. Talk, if you could, a little bit about how that may be changing the game as far as courses that people take online, even in person, or tutoring.
Right. So there's been this dream for a really long time, certainly since the early days of the computing era, starting back in the 1950s and the 1960s, of the machine that would be the perfect teacher. This idea that you could sit a student down in front of a computer or maybe give them something that would be like a tablet or an electronic book. It would teach them things, and then it would learn how to teach them better as they interacted with it. So the dream would be to have a perfect, automated, adaptive tutoring system that ideally could teach a student pretty much anything that they wanted to know on demand. And there have been, kind of over the several decades, a lot of projects that have attempted to build educational systems that would kind of achieve this goal of the perfect automated, on-demand, artificially intelligent tutor that would have self-learning capabilities. So that's one aspect of the application of artificial intelligence to education. In my world, higher education, we're thinking a lot about the problems of cost and access. So I think everybody knows how much the cost of college has continued to increase. It's certainly, as somebody who has young kids, something that's very much on my mind as I think about the future. We're also thinking about how to make college more accessible to students that have traditionally not had access to higher education, and then how to make it possible for them to complete college at greater rates than they're able to do now. Historically, the United States has been very good on both those measures, but there are some very worrying signs that we are now falling behind other parts of the world that have better emphasis on access and completion than we do. So as we think about what does the future of education look like, one of the thoughts is that we can take some of these ideas of personalized learning systems, combine them with ideas like online delivery of content, new models of teaching that might exist, distributed learning, remote learning, and then be able to bridge those together to bring education both to more people, but also to help them succeed more than traditional distance learning that was very much kind of one-directional may have been able to. Mm-hmm. Now, is that going to be easy? No, it's definitely not, but the idea is certainly out there, and you have a lot of people thinking about how to make that possible. Another way in which we have to think about the impact of technology on education is that, you know, even somebody, I'm relatively young, I think, compared to many other people that I'm seeing here, but I was still educated in a very traditional way. So all of my training, all the years that I spent in higher education before I became a professor, it was really somebody at the front of the room talking to us. If you know you went to college, that's pretty probably the standard experience that almost all of us have had. The game has really changed in a big way in the last 5, 10 or so years, where our students are now coming to college expecting to be able to use resources that are available to them and not necessarily seeing me as the professor as the only source of information anymore. And indeed, I think there's a broad movement within the field of teaching and learning to say that should not be my role. I should not be the sage on the stage, we might say, who has the responsibility of being the one-directional transmission of information. So we're always thinking about ways to continue to revise how we teach to take advantage of the information that's available to students, and making better use of technology is a big part of that.
Is there a concern, though, that a university might say, well, look, we can save some money here by getting rid of some of our teaching staff and just having people learn from a bot, essentially?
That will absolutely not happen. It's completely impossible. Well, no, I would like to tell you, as a professor, right, I think there will continue to be professors. Certainly, I hope there will continue to be professors in the future, but I think your point is well taken. When we think about the opportunities that we might have, again, to increase affordability, certainly if technology makes that possible, there's going to be players who will look to bring that to the market and reach students with those options. Mm-hmm. We've already seen significant disruption within higher education where the model of the traditional tenured or tenure-track professor does not describe the majority of faculty that are teaching nowadays. So technology is really another extension of that disruption that's already been in progress for many years now.
And Jeremy, I guess down the track, at some point you might be able to just hop in your car and sit in the back seat and take that course rather than actually having to focus on driving.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I was going to step in and say, I mean, that's the question everyone asks, right? Is the same thing with autonomous vehicles, will truckers not have jobs, taxi cab drivers, things like that. But, I think it goes back to what Walt was saying is that, new industries form around that. There's other jobs that will still be there. And it won't take over everything, right? I mean, it's still very specific, certain things that make more sense for a computer to do than a human to do, and have the humans focus on what they can do best, and vice versa.
What about some of the kind of crossover applications for the work that you do and other forms of transportation or mobility, like, for example, drones or trains or even aircraft?
Sure. So, I mean, there's been a lot of work even before, ground vehicles for aircraft, especially drones, of course, for autonomous flight. That's something that has been looked at for a long time with LIDAR and other sensors as well. It's a very important area, especially for the military. So that's something that is definitely also on the horizon. But it's also easy to kind of remote pilot some of those things where AI isn't always necessary and things like that. So you still have a human element, but you still get the reduced cost from that aspect.
Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking about space exploration, what kind of applications are there for LIDAR and then things like that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good application there, especially something like that where it may not be safe for a human to go. Certainly something like a LIDAR system or any kind of sensor system would be on a robotic vehicle would be optimal in those situations. So, looking at, what those requirements are, how they can help, that's something that, we're looking at adjacent markets as well, but, other companies look at that as well.
Mm-hmm. If you think about autonomous vehicles and if and when we do get to that stage when you can just hop in your car and tell it to do whatever it is you want it to do and do something else while you're being driven somewhere, how much do you have to look at the entire system and worry about things like the system itself getting hacked or things crashing and grinding to a complete halt?
Yeah, so I think cybersecurity and functional safety and things like that are probably the biggest, problem for autonomous driving. And that's why, we're still a long ways off before you'll ever be able to do that. You look at something like our system, You know, right now you'd like to think it's not hackable, things like that, but you have like stories like from Motor Trend magazine where like they hacked the Jeep an infotainment system and they can, you know, open the windows and things like that, and they see how that easy that is, right? So that's something that has to be solved before it'll ever be a commercially available option.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a number in mind or a year when we will be doing what, you know, the autonomous vehicle technology has the potential to allow us to do?
Yeah, so I mean, I think again, it depends on the levels, right? So I think, you know, if you're so level 5, which is the ultimate goal, right, which is complete autonomy, you know, you can go to sleep while the car's driving. You know, that's a long ways off. I don't even know if I could put a number on that. But you know, I think, you know, most optimistically, maybe, you know, 20, 30 years from now or something like that.
Some people seem to be pushing the envelope a little bit.
Yeah,
you do read stories about it.
Yeah,
seeing just how far their cruise control can take them.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can certainly, you know, take your life in your hands and try it out now for sure. But like I said, there's, you know, there's some very successful vehicles now in specific situations where there's not a lot of obstacles and like things are fairly consistent. You know, I think in just probably 5 to 10 years, there'll be a lot more advanced technologies than we have today that will allow very specific full autonomous driving, like within a specific geofenced area or, you know, a specific, you know, highway route, things where it's easily mappable and understood. And then you're really just worrying about unknown obstacles and things like that. So that's going to be the first step. And then, you know, and that, those applications are, you know, trucking and taxi cabs and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Dan, what do you think your students are going to be going on to do in the field of AI? And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what they've been working on in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. as far as research projects and the like.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I think about my students, I think about two different groups. So one is the group of students that are actually in my computer science classes who are majoring or planning to seek employment within software, broadly defined. For a lot of those students, I've had the pleasure to work with some really nice ones who have done honors theses that have had AI elements. We've done a little bit of work in the area of adaptive teaching systems and building some web-based systems that we could use to teach students programming in an adaptive way. I've also had students that have looked at the social implications of artificial intelligence, like looking at how the media reports on the issue of predictive policing and AI in the justice system and the implications of that.
Right, and that's getting into minority report style right. stuff.
Yeah, yeah, potentially. When I think about my computer science majors, what I'm usually thinking about is equipping them with a knowledge of the techniques, the fundamental engineering or theoretical techniques that are the building blocks of modern artificial intelligence. So then they might go for work for a company like Luminar, for example, and then be able to sort of take the engineering knowledge that they have from my classes and apply it into whatever domain that they're going to be seeking employment in. The other group that I work with at Rollins, so we're a liberal arts college, we're in the tradition of liberal education, so another part of our responsibility is training students to be educated citizens, to not just be trained for a career, though we do care a lot about career outcomes and job placement for our graduates, but to be prepared to be kind of participants in a democratic society. And when I teach students in our general education program, I really want them to come away being able to think of artificial intelligence or computer technology generally not as something that's like mysterious or scary or a black box can only be understood by insane wizards. I kind of want people to think about all this stuff as something that kind of everybody here, everybody in this room, everybody that's listening, as an informed citizen, has a right to be able to understand and comment on. So I want to start the discussion with my students and kind of equip them with the confidence that they can understand these issues in an informed way. Even if they're not the people that are going to be programming self-driving cars, they have a right to have an opinion and be able to express that opinion through the media, through the democratic process. Mm-hmm.
So you're really talking about just more data, which we can use to design the future.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a challenging problem because kind of we as a country, as a society, we haven't built the language to be able to talk about this. And this is still seen as something that's very much the province of a small number of very wealthy corporations. We think about Amazon, Google, Facebook. When politicians talk about it, they don't really understand it very well. I think we could probably agree on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very hard to have an intelligent, forward-thinking discussion about these issues, not necessarily out of malice, but just because we haven't figured out how to talk about them yet. We're still in the process of learning about these things.
So Walt, kind of listening to what Dan's saying there, I'm just wondering if that kind of echoes some of what you're thinking about the future. I mean, you seem fairly positive about the potential for AI and our ability to use it in a good way.
We're very positive, and in fact, I wanted to kind of get back to a little bit of the discussion of autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. As an example of why we are excited about the future. Right now, again, we solved the last mile problem. What does that mean? Getting somebody in a vehicle with a bunch of things to do to all the places where they have to do it. Well, where this is rapidly going is it's not just somebody coming to your house. It is the autonomous drone that is going to the house. It is maybe a truck pulling up, and this is happening right now, I think, in England. The truck pulls into a neighborhood, the back of the truck opens up, and a whole set of autonomous delivery robots roll out, and they deliver in the neighborhood.
And people are okay with that?
People are okay with it. And then they all come back, and they get on the truck, and the truck drives away. Okay, so...
Are you not okay with that?
I'm just thinking back to those videos of the robots kind of getting knocked around and jumping back up again.
No, these drones, these robots are very cute, but the point is, what constitutes delivery? What constitutes getting people and goods to customers will be changing, and it is changing very, very rapidly, and having that ecosystem operate effectively is a fascinating and complex problem that, again, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, opens up some amazing new possibilities for new industries, new approaches, and new levels of service that all of us can enjoy.
Mm-hmm. HP, what do you think the future holds for AI?
It's pretty much Terminator. It's pretty much game over. You know, everybody who's predicted it has been wrong. People have been making predictions for 50 years, and they've all been wrong. It really comes down to, you know, who controls it and who wields it. We were talking earlier before. Last week, the Wall Street Journal wrote a report on a bank in England that was defrauded of roughly $250,000 when some AI hackers modeled the voice of the CEO and then called a number of accountants in the company and had them transfer funds out of the company.
So this is like...
This is last
crook
week.
Using deepfakes using
deepfake voice.
Right.
And deepfake, just so you know, is when you take someone's face and put it on someone else's body or someone else's face. A famous one was Jordan Peele, the actor, did President Obama and then trash-talked Donald Trump, and then they showed the split screen of him actually doing it. But there have been more and more instances, especially on Instagram and Facebook, of AIs creating films of people with fake faces that look very, very real. And inside the exhibit, you'll see how they do that, how you motion capture these things. But in this particular case, it was a deep fake voice. Mm-hmm. And they modeled the CEO's voice, used the voice to call the people with access to the money, had them transfer it, and all of a sudden the insurance company's like, that never happened. They don't know who the hackers were, but they had a perfect simulation of the CEO's voice. So those kind of deep fakes is an example of AI in the wrong hands and how it can go bad. As these guys were just talking about, in the right hands, it can be extremely beneficial. You know, we all rely on Siri. We all rely on Google Maps. That's all great stuff. But if somebody starts relying on it to, you know, track your every movement or to pretend that you're someone you're not, then it becomes a dangerous technology.
I want to thank our panelists for joining us this evening. H.P. Newquist is the director of the Science Center's exhibit, AI, Your Mind and the Machine. Thank you so much, H.P.
Thank you very much.
So joined by Dan Myers, Chair of Computer Science in the Department of Math and Computer Science at Rollins College in Winter Park. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
And Walt Wilson, Vice President of Operations for Winter Park-based Fleet Zoo. Thank you so much, Walt.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Joseph, Senior Manager with the Sensor Application Software Department with Luminar Technologies in Orlando. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming and listening.
This episode of Intersection was recorded in front of a live audience at the Orlando Science Center. Thanks to Jeff Stanford, Vice President of Marketing at the Science Centre, and his team. Thanks also to the staff at WMFE, including Interim General Manager Steve Yasko, Chief Engineer Mac Dula, Operations Manager Juan Gualda, Corporate Sponsorship Director Amy Griffith, Sponsorship Specialist Kayla Bloomer, Development Director Vieka Kleinover, Cornerstone Society Manager Christine Hetzel, and Communications and Marketing Specialist Jenny Babcock. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Advent Health. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.